Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World webinar on Thursday, the 6th of August, 2020. And I'm your host, Tamsin Freeman. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Richard Leonard, who's been a fund manager, sell-side stockbroker, hedge fund manager, and now runs a family office. Richard, many, many thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Hi. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how that helps your investing?
In the early 1980s, I came to London to study. And I needed a summer job because I wanted to play cricket up at Mill Hill, which I did. And I became a postboy in the city with Mercury Asset Management, which is, you know, the forerunner to BlackRock from memory. And that postboy ran around the city delivering share certificates and share transfer forms and big checks, because it was all paper in those days and you needed to clear those checks and those certificates. So people like Barclays down at Farringdon or Princes Street with NatWest. And so I ran around the city, and I was then lucky enough to become the sort of gopher filing clerk from a man called Zimmerman, who was an awesome individual, a sort of semi-god round at Mercury Asset Management. His son at one point, I think, was a Jupiter Star fund manager at Jupiter. And I used to file his Excel cards, which gave you all the information that you now find on, you know, things like Bloomberg, the summary of the financial data, report and accounts in appraised form, and the equivalent of the regulatory news service that you see today that you can catch up with online. And that gave me a sort of first understanding. It gave me that reason that I wanted to work in the city, that passion of learning about companies, understanding them. And at the same time, I saw these hobnob type fund managers. In those days, everyone had been to public school and high quality universities. They all had company cars, and I wanted a company car too. So I wanted to become a fund manager, and that's how my dream started.
And what's your investing performance been like over the last 10 years?
Well, over the last 10 years, that's a strong question, in that I left traditional fund management in 2010. So it sort of coincides at that point. And I didn't have an ISA then, because all my money was invested in my hedge fund, as it should be. And I took the money out when I left Cazenove's. I was a hedge fund manager at Cazenove's when I left in 2010. And I started my ISA. And today, my ISA will be worth XYZ, and my annual compounded returns are over 30%.
So what's your investing style, and what are you looking for when you pick stocks to achieve that sort of return?
Primarily, I'm a stock picker, and I was taught to be a stock picker. And I was lucky enough to be taught by an amazing man, a legend of a man, actually, called Richard Smith at Lazard's. And after a number of years doing bookkeeping, etc., in the mid office for investment trusts and unit trusts, I got promoted up. I did my professional qualifications, and I worked for Richard, who ran the UK small cap mid cap desk. And in those days, it was about 500 odd million, and you were competing with some very classy outfits like Andy Brough at Schroders or Chavez Williams at Gartmore. And it was a very tight-knit community, and Richard was a AAA-rated fund manager. We were in the top decile of returns through the 90s, and I was second fund manager, number two fund manager that joined him. Previous to that was a man called Abiba Noose, who went equally on to amazing things, and became a partner of Capital, although he's just retired. And I was taught by Richard. And Richard's investment philosophy is still today my investment philosophy as a stock picker. And that philosophy is to look at businesses where I can believe I can make money. And how do I make money? I make money principally by understanding and measuring those businesses. And the first principle is to look at the business risk. And the business risk is SWOT type analysis. You know, where are the weaknesses, where are the strengths and where are the weaknesses and the opportunities combined with the threats. And so you look for barriers to entry. What's the competitive edge? What's the landscape? Is there structural growth or is there declining growth? Declining growth would be a classic example in the UK, would be the pottery industry. You know, there's no pots of value in that now because it's all out of Asia. And so it's interrogating the business risk as the first principle. The second principle would be the financial risk. What type of returns are you seeing the company achieve? Returns on capital invested, returns on equity, but primarily in particular, and they're all combined into those equations, is what are your margins? What are your return on sales? And generally, I look for return on sales of in excess of 10% where they are sustainable. So I look for predictable, sustainable revenues. They attract me considerably. Good example of that would be Rentokil. But Rentokil's on 42 times. Oh, I'm not sure I can make money at 42 times. That's an earnings yield, by the way, of 2.5%. I just think that's for the birds, however good a business it is. So if you like a business, you believe the financial characteristics are good, the last question you have to ask yourself is, how do I make money? And you look at valuation risk. So generally speaking, I look for companies with a PE, let's say a price earnings multiple of less than 20 times. That doesn't exclude me from owning companies over 20 times, but I've got to tell you, it's very rare that I do so. And hopefully, you buy stocks to make money. And however good a Rentokil story is with those recurring revenues, on 42 times, I'm not interested.
So we've had COVID going on. How have you responded to COVID? Did you see it coming in February? What have you been doing with it?
Well, interestingly, as a private investor in a private wealth business, we're not regulated. And I run my PA alongside the money that I manage at Trium, which is a private wealth business. And at Trium, I run a long short book, like a hedge fund, a mini hedge fund. And it's rather dynamic. What do I mean by that? We move money very quickly. We can own stocks for 3 minutes, three days, 3 months, or 3 years. And at the beginning of the year, we were very hesitant about market valuation levels. We considered using the American indices in particular, because we trust those indices for choice in terms of their overall exposure. The US market was on 18, 19 times, with the belief that earnings would be in the region of 7-8%. We believe those earnings would come down as we progress through the year. So actually, at the beginning of the year, not because of the virus, but because of valuation levels, we were actually net short the market. And we were right to be. And yet in early February, markets hit all-time highs. And that was in the face, remember, of the news flow coming out of China, out of Northern Italy. And with all the risks wrapped around 2020 presidential election, Brexit negotiations still to happen, and other factors as well, such as the Chinese tariff war potential too. So we were net short, and in early February, we lost on earth. We covered those shorts. And although I was building cash up as well in my PA portfolios, we couldn't see value. We just couldn't see value. And so did we call the virus? We didn't call the virus, the truth be known. And we were short the market and then lost our nerve. So as it turned out, in March and April, it became extremely painful. And so did I foresee it? No. Did I foresee it when it then started to hit home in early March? Yes. What did I do? I ran. I absolutely ran, because this is my personal money wrapped up in stock markets, and 95% of my money is in equities, because that's where my skill base is. And it's primarily UK small cap, mid cap, small cap in particular, where you have a huge liquidity risk. And so the first thing I did was I ran, and I ran for cash. And by early April, my cash was about 90%.
What were you expecting to happen?
Well, that's a fair question. I didn't know what to expect. I'd never seen anything like this before. So I didn't have a roadmap. And the downdraft of equity markets was as quick as we've ever seen. Even the 1929, to 1932 correction, you'd never seen anything like this. You know, FTSE fell from 7,500 from memory to under 5,000 in very quick fashion. And attached to that, dividends were being cut left, right, and centre. If you look at the dividends of 2019, over 104 billion were paid. Dividends are likely to be cut by 40, 50, and I think it could be even more. So companies coming off the dividend list, like banks, etc., and companies that have never seen the likes of this before in terms of revenue. I spoke to Stagecoach recently. Their revenues fell by 90%. And even now, they're only up to mileage of 60, and their patronage levels of passengers on seats, i.e., is running at about 40. So we've never seen anything like this before. And my first reaction, I was stuck in Spain, as it turned out, was that I panicked, and I brought cash back to bank, because that's what I was taught to do. If you don't know what you're doing, get the hell out. And that's exactly what I did. I made some massive mistakes in the process.
So you had 90% cash at the beginning of April. So what have you been doing since? Which sectors have been appealing to you, and what's been your strategy since?
The policy response by central governments and by central banks in particular, in terms of the amount of QE that they were looking to push into markets, and the way they were pushing real yields lower and lower, in actual fact, negative. So you've got negative real rates combined with huge mountains of QE. The Federal Reserve, for example, now has a $7 trillion balance sheet. Debt to GDP in the United States, including local and state debt, is over 150 and ticking higher. At the beginning of the year, it was 100. So it was initially the policy response, which was far greater than I anticipated. But as soon as that started to happen, and I started to see things like gold ratchet up as well. Gold's up at over 2,000 now. Was actually equities are becoming more and more the alternative. And because it gave me a blank piece of paper, which was the only good thing I did, it gave me the opportunity to look for good companies, companies that maybe I've never owned before. And I've got a couple of examples of that later when we talk about what I've been buying. And that's what I've been doing. I've been utilizing my cash. And so although by middle of April, year to date, in the middle of April, I was down probably about 20-ish%, 25%. And today I'm now down year to date about 10, maybe slightly more.
And what sectors have you been looking at in terms of avoid and what you want to buy into?
Yeah, it's a fair question. It's more what do I want to avoid, and what I want to avoid is classically the sectors that are consumer facing. We are almost certainly going to see an absolute huge wave of unemployment in the UK, Europe, and the US. The US is over 30 million as we speak, and so it's more the sectors I want to stay away from. I want to stay away from transport. I want to stay away from retail facing unless it's got real internet online presence. I want to stay away from hospitality, hotels, leisure, bowling alleys. I just simply want resilience of earnings, resilience of revenue. And they're difficult to find, by the way, in an environment that we have at the moment. And as an absolute return fund manager, you know, going back to my career, the last few years of my normal career, as I would call it, rather than my alternative career, which is now the one I have today, is I'm an absolute return fund manager. And if markets fall, I don't really enjoy my wealth falling. And if someone were to turn to you and say, "Oh, well, I've got a relative outperformance," like a Schroders fund manager might, I would say, "Well, you can't eat a relative lunch." So I always look for value. But interestingly, I also look for an absolute positive return. And in these markets, that's incredibly difficult to find. So I look for companies with a strong business franchise, which I can understand and measure, where there's not high financial risk and where I'm buying at a valuation which I can understand and believe that I can make money from. So sectors, it's more the sectors I'm missing. I don't really invest in property. It's linear. It's highly financially geared. And I generally am not a good stock picker in that arena. I don't invest in blue sky. I don't invest in biotech, for example. If I wanted to invest in biotech, I'd go to a casino and put it all on red and see if I was lucky. So I don't invest in blue sky. I don't invest in those types of arenas. Oil and gas, very rare, unless it's production led. And I've done that sometimes. But it's more the sectors where I feel comfortable in that I look to find value. There will be a time to look for value in the consumer related areas. But given the question that you've asked, where am I investing? I'm investing at this particular point with the sort of Cazenove, that's the last firm I worked for, where I helped run the UK hedge fund money in the period 2005 to 2010, was a business cycle philosophy. And if we're going to make money from this juncture, it's got to be on the belief that we're at the start of the business cycle. And so that's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at companies that have some sort of resilience of earnings, and you can hopefully tap into the recovery that we will see on the economic front anywhere in the world.
But you're not looking sector specific. You're not saying, oh, tech's going to be a winner.
Well, tech is going to be a winner without question. You can see that evidently from the Microsoft numbers, from Apple, from Amazon, from Facebook. Were amazing. You know, if you looked at the NASDAQ level of NASDAQ at the turn of the century, NASDAQ hit 5,000. The dot-com bubble burst and the NASDAQ more than halved from memory, or close to halved, halving. And today, NASDAQ's near 11,000. By the way, FTSE hit 7,000 on Christmas Eve, 1999. And so you've made no money in capital terms in the FTSE. You've only had income by dividends. Oh, by the way, those dividends have just been cut by 40, 50%. Shell were paying their dividend out of the balance sheet. That's simply not acceptable. It's not sustainable. Going back to those principles that I look at, cash flow is absolutely critical in terms of me understanding the business. So I don't like acquisitionally driven businesses either, because they never stand still long enough. And I call them plate spinners. And you see it for a long while, fund managers, professional fund managers, whether they work for Invesco or Schroders or Jupiter or Lazard, they all jump on the wagon sometimes of these plate spinning, acquisitionally led businesses. But actually, you really need to interrogate the true sort of investment returns that those companies are making, and they're very, it's very difficult to do when they're constantly acquiring businesses. So I generally also stay away from acquisitionally led businesses unless I really believe that there's an opportunity to make money from them.
So what have you been buying?
Generally speaking, so I run a very concentrated portfolio. I only limit myself to 16 holdings. Don't ask me why it's 16. It just is 16. Although my favourite number is 4, and 4 times 4 gets you to that number. So I'm highly concentrated. I will have a stock turn of around 2 times on an annualised basis. So I'm owning a stock between 6 and 9 months. Last year, I had my best ever investment return year, and it began with an 8, and I'll give you a clue that it didn't have a 0 in front of it. And some of those returns I made were from the likes of Lion Trust, Computer Center, Checkit, Reach, the Trinity Mirror business, and a few others. And my holding period, 6 to 9 months. Lion Trust I'd owned for over 2.5 years, but it hit that sort of that sound discipline of mine, where it sort of touched 20 times earnings. And you know, where do I make money from there? So I don't own Lion Trust anymore. And so I had to find an alternative to Lion Trust. And so I decided to, you know, start digging and delving when I had 90% of my wealth in net cash. And in early May, I started buying Polar Capital, which is a business I know quite well from my stockbroking days. And I know the management team very well. And so I picked up the phone and I spoke to the finance director. The finance director happens to be an ex-colleague of mine at Lazard's, a brilliant man called John Mansell. And Polar Capital was my first entry back into the stock market. Although interesting, what you haven't asked is what was the one stock I didn't sell? What was the company I didn't sell?
And what was it?
It was a company called Totally, which is an outsourcer to the NHS. Again, the chairman is a friend of mine, a guy called Bob Holt, who's not everyone's cup of tea. He's a bit Marmite-like. However, he's built a brilliant team around him at Totally. And they, in effect, do the outsourcing for GP surgeries for accident and emergency centres around the UK. And it's a business that generates cash. It's got predictable contractual revenues, and it's very cheap. And so I actually continued to buy Totally through March and April when nobody wanted to sell it. And I wasn't the only seller, remember, in that period. The market had the biggest downdraft in living memory. And so my current positioning is starting to look towards the business cycle. And as I say, the first stock I bought in a new stock position I bought in sort of early May was Polar.
And what else were you buying?
I bought some St. James's Place because they were holding up very well with their numbers. I didn't go back to buy Telecom Plus, which I probably should have, to be fair. I bought a mining, it's a bit like an investment trust called Anglo-Pacific Mining, which actually I've lost money on so far. I've bought a company called Franchise Brands when it was down on its knees, which is an extremely well-led business. I like to own companies where there's a very decent family or management interest in the shareholding of a company. So I started buying Franchise Brands, which I still own. And that's an interesting point. If I've owned a stock for more than 29 days, I've done some regression analysis on my holding periods and on my stock picks. And if I own a stock for more than 29 days, I've got a 95% hit rate of making money. I'm hoping Anglo Pacific Mining is not one of them. And I've got a portfolio today of about 12 stocks in total. And the first one I bought was Polar, as I mentioned. The second one was Anglo Pacific Mining. To be honest, I can't remember exactly the shape of when I bought and when I have sold a few. So I sold St. James's Place. I've been buying some Legal in general because I just think it's simply too cheap. It's got a dividend. Dividends attract me, and in an environment where they're not being paid particularly well at the moment, that's the opportunity too, to find companies where you think they can continue to grow, where their earnings are sustainable and they're rewarding shareholders for their patience. So dividends are actually on my target list to look at now. And maybe we'll touch on that when you ask me, you know, my ideas at the present time.
And what would prompt you to sell? Because selling is often the most difficult thing to do.
A lot of it's instinct. I have to tell you, it's a lot of it's instinct. I don't know if you've ever, when you've ever been with a builder or a carpenter, and it's incredibly annoying. You see a carpenter with a pencil behind his ear, and I watched this with real interest when I was a younger man. And this carpenter was putting lines in, you know, along some wood, and I said, "Well, why aren't you using a tape measure or a ruler or whatever?" He said, "I just know. It's instinct." I don't like overvalued companies, like I mentioned earlier. And if I found a new idea, remember that concentration point that I made. I only hold stocks on average for 6 to 9 months. Some stocks I only own for a month. You know, St. James's Place would be an example. Are there sectors that I avoid? Yes. But there are also sectors where maybe I've got too much concentration in as well. And so, you know, I limit myself to, you know, I want a reasonably well-diversified portfolio. And it's very difficult to get that when you've only got 16 stocks to pick from. And generally, I will have 20, 25 new ideas a year. And so there's a natural culling, if you like. And one of the things I learned in fund management, and I think young fund managers in particular need to learn this, is that you don't want to be cutting your flowers to water your weeds. So if you found a winner, run it, like Lion Trust, that I had through 2017, and I sold it at the back end of last year. You know, you run your winners, and those adages are absolutely correct today, as they always will be. So how do I, what's my sales discipline? Partly it's instinct. Partly it's knowledge of those valuation yardsticks that we touched on earlier. And actually, if I'm being brutally honest, it's finding room for the new idea. I always believe that I can find the next winner. And you've got to have belief in fund management. And you've certainly got to have belief in these types of markets at the moment. And it's sort of going back to what I said earlier. For the first time in a long time, I feel like I've got the ball at the end of my foot. When I was locked down in Spain, you know, I thought the world was ending. It was wet and grisly. It was a horrible period in my life. And I suspect lots of other people had that period too. And so coming back to London for the last month, I feel for the first time I've got the ball at the end of my foot. And why do I have that confidence? The policymakers are going to make equities an unbelievably attractive proposition. We are going to make an obscene amount of money in the equity markets over the next 12, 18 months. Yes, there's going to be hurdles to cross over. Brexit, the Brexit negotiations is an example. Presidential elections are an example. The spats that are going on with China are an example. But they've got to get the unemployed and the furloughed people back to work. And so the policy response, we've seen the monetary policy response, and that will continue. And that's why people are being pushed into equity markets. And that will continue. What we haven't yet seen is the fiscal response. My God, when you see the fiscal response, it will be like the Marshall Plan revisited of the 1940s, 1950s. And it will be led almost certainly by the US. I fear the European community. I fear a sovereign debt crisis, probably 12, 18 months away. And so I'm going to stay very fluid. What do I mean by that? I'll be prepared to increase my cash holdings substantially if I fear that there's going to be another stock market correction. But I don't think they're going to. The Fed and the ECB and the Bank of England, they've in effect underwritten equity markets. And I've never seen that before in my career. And so, yes, I made some massive mistakes in March. I should have been more patient. I should have house kept my positions, my stock positions at the time, of which one or two of them were really very, very good companies. And the best example of that would be Telecom Plus. I'd love Telecom Plus to come back to, you know, to sub £10, and I'd buy the shirt off it. And so I keep an eye on share prices. There's not a moment of the day that I'm not looking at share price moves over one day, 3 months, 3 years. And you've got to live and breathe. You've got to have that passion of understanding share prices and why they're there, both on the top-down macro approach as well as the bottom-up stock-picking approach. So that's pretty much where I am at the moment. I think we are going to make a lot of money in this stock market.
So you mentioned Telecom Plus being on your watch list. What else are you keeping on your watch list?
What am I looking at the moment? I'm looking at M&G. I've owned M&G in the past. I think it's a undervalued situation. I think it's a misunderstood recovery story with a very good brand. I've met them on a number of occasions. I get a real benefit from being in a private wealth business like Trium. I get to see a lot of companies. I speak to a lot of management teams, either on the telephone or in person. And so I think M&G in valuation terms is absolutely cheap as chips. It's on around 7x earnings, and it's got a hell of a dividend yield as well. And they will pay their dividend. Why haven't I bought it at this point? I'm waiting for results. Results are next week. Will they be spectacular? No. Do they need to be? No. I'm hoping the stock falls because I'd like to actually buy M&G. on that investment case that I've just pointed out. I'm looking at Ted Baker. I do own Ted Baker. Potentially, it's got the most amazing recovery story in the whole of the FT All Share. Probably the best recovery opportunity. But I haven't bought it yet in real size. And the reason for that is I want to meet the management. And that's what we do here at Tree, and we meet a lot of management teams. We speak to them either verbally on Zoom or we go to their offices or they come to ours. Or we meet them at stockbrokers, we meet them at conferences, etc. And so I probably do 300 plus meetings a year where I'm meeting management, interrogating them, filtering through their results, and then cross-referencing that with market forecasts. You do not want to be owning a company that has a downgrade. And especially in this market, an earnings downgrade that is driven maybe out of the environment we're in at the moment or driven out of a lack of margin or a lack of top line growth. And so meeting management's key. Ted Baker, I suspect I will end up buying a bigger position in, but we're meeting management next week. I'm looking at Spectris, which is the measurement engineering business. It's not cheap. It's about 20 times earnings next year. And again, results recently, and I thought they were excellent results, and the stock market, the share price actually fell on the day. But yet the company is financially as sound as a bell, net cash of over 35 million, and they're paying a dividend, and they're paying a catch-up dividend. So that really interests me. And it's a high-quality business, gross margins of over 60%. This is a business, it used to be called Fairy in the 90s, and it's quite a disparate set of businesses in there. It's about 16 different divisions, or it might be 15 now, but it's very high quality. It's late cycle typically because it finds its equipment in industrial processing to improve productivity. But actually going forward in the world we're in, I suspect Spectris is very well placed to recover strongly as we walk out of these recessionary conditions that we're in at the moment.
And you do have three companies that you've prepared. So do you want to talk us through those a little bit?
Yes, that's good. Okay. Well, I mentioned Polar Capital earlier. And Polar Capital was the first business I started to acquire in early May when I decided to venture out, so to speak. Polar Capital is a market cap of 440 million. It's been listed for some time. It's a niche specialist asset management. So it's a bit like Lion Trust. The difference between Lion Trust and Polar Capital is that Polar Capital trades on 10, 11 times earnings. Lion Trust trades on 20. Lion Trust has also become a little bit of a plate spinner, which I mentioned earlier. It made a lot of acquisitions. Polar doesn't make acquisitions. What Polar does, it buys in specialist fund management teams, and it's got a well diversified set of specialist skills in the equity arena in particular. And its best performing team, and when I say best performing team, this is a team that are best of the best. They run the Polar Capital Investment Trust. The total assets under management in Polar are about 15 billion. And that team run approximately 50% of those assets. So there's a big concentration risk. But when I say they're the best of the best, you only need to look up the investment trust that I mentioned earlier, Polar Capital Investment Trust. PCT is the ticker. This is a five bagger since 2013. When you meet them, they are so much more passionate than even I am. You just
is
want
that possible?
To buy the, not just the investment trust. Yeah, no, it's possible, trust me. And so the Polar team in technology are best in class. And you can see that from their returns. And the inflows that Polar is still seeing just from that side of the business, which you may argue is concentrated, is outstanding. And they've now had 13 up months of inflows of capital contributions into their funds under management over the last 15. Brilliantly run. I mentioned John Mansell earlier. I worked with John at Lazard's, and I'm able to get on the phone to him two or three times a year and have a catch up. This is a business with 100 plus million of cash on its balance sheet, of at least 70 million-ish of surplus capital that they could return to you tomorrow. And so the dividend is incredibly well protected. Oh, I've mentioned that. It's on a yield of 6.7%. So they pay out three quarters of their earnings in dividend because they don't need the cash. It's an incredibly capital light business. They seed some of their opportunities, and that's why I really want to buy this business. It's not because of the technology team. That's good enough reason. But they brought in a team for emerging markets, and they've seeded it with 150 million. This is a team, and I've gone back and looked at the track record. It's as good as I've ever seen. And they ran with their previous employers 5 billion. So my suspicion is that over the next 2 or 3 years, Polar Capital, today 15 billion under management, I suspect over the next 3 or 4 years, with 70% of their funds outperforming their peer group and their benchmark, I suspect they will double assets under management. Their exposure to technology is unbelievably outstanding. And go and check that those statistics that I've made. They're right, by the way. And on a valuation of 11 times earnings, with ongoing upgrades from the market. So Numis, their broker, upgraded on Monday by 10%. The stock's hardly moved. You know, it's just off people's radar screen. Liquidity's not great, but that's an advantage to me. I actually don't mind illiquidity when I want to buy something, because the experience that we've got here at Trium, which is the wealth manager that I work for, is that we've got some of the best dealers that the stock market's seen over the last 20, 30 years. They're in their retirement years. And so if I want to buy Polar Capital, I'll go and give it to one of my dealers to go and find. And so Polar Capital is probably my top pick. It's also my largest holding, and I'm also very happy to continue to buy it. So with a bit of luck, it won't go up, it will go down, because I want to buy more. On a 7% yield and 11 times earnings, this company will be re-rated, and it will be re-rated on earnings upgrades, which I mentioned earlier. It had an upgrade of 10% on Monday. I suspect further upgrades to follow, and I expect further news flow on other activities within the company, i.e. bringing in additional teams that will start to move the dial in terms of that asset base that it has today. I think they will double their assets under management in the next 4 or 5 years. And in share price terms, that means I think this share price in today's money, not tomorrow's money, I think today's money, I think the stock's worth over £9.
And your next pick?
My next pick, I've been acquiring in the last few days, which is probably why the share price has been pushed higher, if I'm being honest, is a company called Ultimate Products. The ticker is UPGS. Market cap is, I think, about 100 odd million. And I believe that this stock deserves a re-rating. What do Ultimate Products do? This was a business, by the way, that was floated a few years ago, and we got quite close to them when they floated. We do a lot of meetings, as I mentioned earlier, with companies, and we took the guys out for lunch. And this is a company that designs and develops a series of branded focus products for the house, for the household. So you and I would have heard of Morphe, Richards, we'd have heard of Russell Hobbs, we would have heard of Clean Easy. And they do typically audio, heating, laundry, luggage, ladies' products such as hair dryers or straighteners, etc. And they're highly adaptable to new design and new product innovation. And they do all of their manufacturing offshore in China. So if you go back to the share price, it actually got knocked heavily in the early parts of the year because the question mark over China, not just with regards to the US and tariff wars, but you know, because of the flu. And they design and develop, and then they distribute into predominantly the UK, predominantly I say, but their international presence is growing at a pace in Germany and the Netherlands and Benelux in particular. And they trade on an incredibly cheap PE. They're incredibly well managed. Management team own 40, 50, depending on how you measure it, even more of the company. So they've got their head very much on the block. And I really look for that too. and their customers are people like B&M, the discounters, Sainsbury's, Tesco's, all of the names in the high street that you would expect if you want to find yourself, you know, a decent branded product at good value, such as a Russell Hobbs or a Morphy Richards. And the stock trades on about 9x earnings. It's had two upgrades. It had a release at the end, at the beginning of June, upgrade. Had another update in July, upgrade. Do you think another upgrade's coming? I think so. And I suspect that upgrade comes when they next report in September, if not earlier. And in effect, what they're doing is they're refilling the supply chain, because the supply chain's been sucked dry because everyone's been at home. I started to meet the Amazon courier in Spain. I'm going to send the guy a Christmas card. You know, we became friends. My wife was ordering so much stuff. And so the presence that they have in the high street is clearly evident. But that's not what the real sexy opportunity is. It's online. It's Amazon. So these guys 5 years ago did online of 3%. They're doing north of 20 now, and it's growing at sort of 30% per annum. So when you start to look at the turnover and you start to look at the gross margins are not great. They're about 25%. But sterling's going in their favor as well because of their sourcing ability overseas. And they've got all the right tentacles in the relationships that they have with the discounters, you know, people like B&M, people like Tesco's and alike. But the overseas exposure that they have is also very exciting. And that's in the Benelux, people like Action, which 3i have a big holding in. And so actually, when you start to look at the forecasts and the earnings and the cash flow, I think this company is now debt free. I think they do a dividend catch up at some point, which is another reason I want to own it. And I suspect the re-rating takes you probably to around 110, 115. Now, at that point, going back to that question you asked, where would I sell a stock? That probably, you know, it's not going to be a stock I own for the next 2.5 years. But I do believe it will be re-rated. People like Andy Brough, who I noticed was on your show a couple of weeks ago, owns it. And it's an exceptionally well-run business, not high visibility in terms of its turnover. And that goes again to that quality threshold that I always look for. And so therefore, I'm looking for further upgrades. I'm looking for further cash flow, which will supplement the dividend. And, you know, at some point I will hopefully see the stock north of £1. And at that point, I would probably start to let stock go.
And very, very briefly, because we want time for questions, give us your third company.
My third company is probably the one that I make the most money in. And I say that because it's the one I know best. When I was a fund manager at Lazard's, I owned our largest holding was Good Durant. And Good Durant is a van hire business. The Waring family, South African family, were the primary owners of it. But they bought a business called Northgate in the mid-90s. Northgate is a van hire business. And through the 90s and noughties, incredibly well run until it wasn't. And then a number of new management teams came in and it was shockingly badly run. And if you go and look at the chart of Good Durant, it suffered in the 07-08 period due to the financial crisis. But now, given its returns, given the opportunity it has with new management, and that's the key to this story, it's new management. A guy called Martin Ward's come in and it merged with Ready, which is an insurance car hire business. And they've put the two together and you can get the synergies. They're easy to understand. It's depot synergies, it's maintenance synergies, and it's overhead distribution sales synergies. And Martin Ward went into Ready and recovered it and rescued it. The new chair lady called Avril Palmer. I know Avril as Avril, let's make more money, Palmer. And she brought BCA back to the market. She brought BCA to the market and she started her career, funny enough, at Northgate. So these guys know how to run this business and they are going to run this business and they're going to turn it around. returns on capital are probably not what I would expect. And so I would expect those to recover strongly. And I would expect actually this to be a cyclical, contra-cyclical business because it's rental. And right now you can see the structural growth online, white man in a van. That white van that I kept on going to meet in Spain was an example. And that's what made me look at Good Durant or Northgate or Ready, as I call it now. And so I think the re-rating opportunity is unbelievable. Even in the current period, with the current demand that we're seeing, you're going to see 25 plus P of earnings. If you add the restructuring benefits with the Ready merger that Martin Ward will deliver, in my view, you get to 28 pence of earnings. That's without any recovery on the top line. I just mentioned that I want to be in this stock market now at the beginning of the new business cycle, and Northgate will recover into that cycle. At the same time, the balance sheet's been incredibly well managed. Why? Because they're degrossing the fleet at the moment because of the demand functionality that we've just touched on with regards to the lockdown virus that we're seeing at the present time. So if you combine that all together and you look at the NAV, the price per book, the tangible price per book, it's £2.46. This stock's trading at 175. You're buying 70p in the pound for a recovery story that's probably as good as I've ever seen. It's probably ranks with the recovery stories you saw with Ashtead. 2012, Ashtead was a share price of £2. It was one of my best performers in that year. It was one of my best ever performance years. Ashtead's £25 a share now. Management team changed that story in the Sunbelt rental business. Compass, Richard Cousins joined around the 2004-05, recovered the story, and Compass today is a FTSE darling, correctly so. Rentokil, Rentokil was so badly managed. It was, I used to call it that you couldn't polish the turnip. It was so poorly managed. In 2012, new management came in. Rentokil was on 42 times earnings now. Northgate, Ready, is on less than six. And it's also, in my view, going to do a dividend catch up. And it's also, in my view, going to pay a dividend of in excess of 12 pence going forward. So you've got everything in Northgate, a recovery of management, a recovery in the top line because of the cyclical benefits that I've just touched on. And in terms of valuation, you're going to have a triple, you're going to have a triple positive.
And we've got a question here from Jay Shaw. What do you think on the UK market if another lockdown comes or no COVID drug is found for 2 months? He says, I hold UPGS, so it's a good choice.
the UK market is almost, the FTSE in particular, is controlled by the banks, the oil companies, pharmaceutical, which is clearly defensive and benefits from the virus. In the medium to longer term, I'm sure all the boats go up when the tide comes in. And I suspect the FTSE will enjoy, you know, the benefits of an economic surge that I believe will recover into 2021-22. This virus isn't going away. You know, let's wake up and smell the coffee. It's not going away. And we're going to have to live with it as a human race. And we're almost certainly going to see regional lockdowns. And that's almost certainly going to create greater volatility in the stock market. Do we see a virus? Do we see a treatment for this virus? Yes, I believe we will. You know, there's three big tickets out there. It's Oxford, Pfizer or Astra. I'd probably put my money on Astra for choice. But I don't invest in Astra. I don't generally invest in pharmaceutical companies unless I want to part money. And if I'm going to part money, I'm going to leave it on the sidelines. I'm positive on FTSE, but I'm only positive on FTSE because I'm positive on equity markets, full stop.
And Joe Evans asks, what's happening to the NAV of Ready on a mark to market basis?
Wow. That's an outstanding question. If I was to ask a question, that's the question I would have asked. It's going up. Why is it going up? Well, Okay, so I gave you three benefits. I'll give you a fourth now. The NAV is going up because retained earnings are going up. It's going up because they're disposing of vehicles. Why are they disposing of vehicles? Because they're degrossing. Well, that brings more cash in and that reduces debt. But residual profits are up. Why are residual profits up? Because if you want to buy a secondhand van or a secondhand car, you're having to pay up for it because the demand's out there. That's that contracyclicality that I argued earlier. That is a brilliant question. And actually, that's the nail. That's why you buy it. It's a really good question. Thank you.
Bill Hall asks, your investment style is very different from the likes of Nick Train and Terry Smith. Is there anything that they do that you would like to follow? It's hard to believe that they would add a company like UPGS to their concentrated portfolios.
They're limited. When I was a hedge fund manager at Cazenodes with Tim Russell, I helped run a $1.5 billion. We didn't have any flexibility. Now, I got incredibly well paid. Terry Smith, the man is a legend, and I've met him on a number of occasions. I've met Nick Train, and Nick Train is a brilliant fund manager. But they are running huge pools of money. I have the flexibility and ability at Trium. We run 100 million, okay, of which the founding partner and I probably run about a half of it. If I want to move, I can move. If I want to buy Northgate, if I want to go into the market now and buy Northgate vans, I can buy 1 million shares. I won't have a problem. If Nick Train or Terry Smith want to buy a concentrated position, it takes them months. Andy Bruth takes months to buy positions. The reason I decided to do what I'm doing now was to give me the flexibility. And I wanted to own my own destiny. And you can see that from Neil Woodford. Neil Woodford didn't own his own destiny.
And Jasper Skinner asks, Richard, what other stocks are you looking at and why?
Yeah, okay. Well, we sort of touched on that earlier, didn't we? I'm looking at Ted Baker. I do own Ted Baker, but only in a very small way. I'm owning Ted Baker because potentially it has one of the best recovery stories. Fantastic brand, helped float the business in the 1990s. And I know Ray Calvin very well. And I actually say he also used to give me lots of cuddles as well. The world's moved on and Ray's left the business. The lady, Rachel, and I can't remember Rachel's surname, who's the new chief executive, she has an awesome opportunity to recover that story. And if you look at the business today with a market cap of 186 million shares in issue, and it's about 70-odd per share, 75p a share, the cash on the balance sheet and the inventory stock on the balance sheet is greater than the market cap. You rarely see that opportunity. I'm not going hung-ho into it at the moment, though, because I want to meet management. But that is an example of a company I'm looking at. I'm looking at Spectris earlier that I mentioned. And actually, I'm constantly looking at new holdings. I probably bring into my portfolio 20 new holdings a year. And probably the one I'm most excited about that I'm looking at is Ted Baker. But I just want to meet management.
Richard, thank you very much indeed. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. I think you're saying...
I've only just got started.
I could talk to you all afternoon. I think you've said that if people want to get in touch with you, then they should email via me. So on the PI World website, if you enter an email into the contact form there, I can forward that to Richard. But thank you very, very much for a superb webinar.
I really enjoy it.
Oh, good. If you want an email notification of webinars or events PI World are organising, go to the right-hand side of the homepage at piworld.co.uk. There are two boxes. On the top, sign up for notifications of a new video as it's published, and underneath, sign up for events. Different lists, no spam. And please do tell your investing friends about PI World and write comments or like our videos on Twitter, bulletin boards and YouTube. We also produce all the videos as a podcast, so do write reviews for the podcast on iTunes. We'd like to go on providing these free webinars and getting really good speakers like Richard relies on you and the audience numbers we attract. If you have ideas of speakers, do email or message me. You can find me through the contact page at piworld.co.uk or do follow me on Twitter at TamsinPIWorld. Many thanks to you all for joining us and stay well. And thank you to Richard. PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.